beauty mirrors grace in how it comes to us undeserved, and in this case, even in some ways, unsought for consciously. We don't even perhaps know always that we're seeking beauty. You might be, as I was this morning, driving down a rural Oklahoma highway on the way to campus, and suddenly astounded by the sunrise. And I was not in search of a sunrise, certainly, and I wasn't thinking about beauty. I was thinking about faculty meetings. And suddenly there it was, just sort of offering itself to me, right? And so it's the wonderfully gratuitous nature of art that I think gives it that ability to mirror the way grace is experienced and works in the world.
Benjamin Myers is the Crouch Mathis Professor of Literature and the director of the Honors Program at Oklahoma Baptist University. A former poet laureate of the state of Oklahoma, Ben is the author of 4 books of poetry and 2 books of nonfiction. We discuss 2 of those books today, a 2020 critical work titled A Poetics of Orthodoxy, Christian Truth as Aesthetic Foundation, and his beautiful 2022 collection of poems, The Family Book of Martyrs. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Ben, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's good to see you today.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I love listening to the podcast, so I'm thrilled to be on it.
Well, it's great to have you here. I've been a keen reader of your work, and it's great to have a chance to talk with you about it on the podcast here. Now, listeners who caught my conversation with George Hanley a couple months back on things you read in 2023, they'll know that your collection of poems, The Family Book of Martyrs, one of my favorite books from last year. Of course, you published it in 2022, not 2023, so I was a year late. Nonetheless, Ben, a favorite book. We're talking about that book, but I wonder if we could begin by talking about another book that you wrote in 2020. This is a critical work titled A Poetics of Orthodoxy, subtitled Christian Truth as Aesthetic Foundation. Now, you mentioned in the book's introduction that you were a writer before you were a Christian. And that, as you put it in the book, I'm quoting you here, after you came to Christ, you marveled at the rich resources for aesthetics found in the Christian faith. Can you tell us first about what brought you to Christianity?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My journey to faith, I like to remind my preacher friends or tell my preacher friends, didn't happen as a result of a sermon. It was in a Lessons and Carols service at Christmas time. So it was really... it was the story and beauty that just sort of flattened me at that moment with the truth of the thing. I was one of those young men. This was in college, and you know, I'd spent years sort of dancing around the gospel and sort of treating it allegorically and treating it poetically in some ways, but never taking it seriously. And then just the through this wonderful Lessons and Carols service, just the force of the truth of the story as the story at the heart of all other stories just completely convinced me. So I walked into Christmas Chapel, essentially a pagan, and walked out a Christian.
Wow. You know, I like how you said the story and the beauty, both things that appeal to a humanities professor like me and like you, right?
Yes.
Now, I can almost hear in my head, you may have heard this too many times, the criticism, right? That Christianity doesn't provide resources for aesthetics or for beauty as much as it kind of contains or restricts or constrains, right, especially I should say, our open, unbiased engagement of the world on its own terms. Right? Yeah. Christianity kind of gives us a template. It doesn't kind of open us to the world. It kind of closes us down. Here's my question for you. Do you agree at all with that assertion? If so, or if not, then what exactly does Christianity bring, or what might it bring to our understanding and appreciation of beauty?
Yeah. You know, my scholarly instinct is always to be nuanced and say, well, I can't completely disagree with something. But in this case, I find myself sort of really completely disagreeing.
Okay.
You know, it's because if I had known beforehand just the poetic richness of the Psalms alone, it just amazed me to find, because I had that same impression as a young man. Oh, Christianity is all about, what not to do, and it's all about the restrictions and the binding. And I had no idea that this was a faith that had at its heart this deep, rich, and complex poetic tradition and way of processing experience with God through poetry. And that's just the Psalms. When we add Ecclesiastes and Job and the sort of poetic flights within Paul's letters to the Corinthians. So I was astounded at just how much poetry itself there was in the faith. But then also, I couldn't help but notice as I studied more in the Christian tradition that traditional Christian metaphysics offers a lot to the artist, because in that tradition, the God who says to Moses, I am, who is synonymous with being, is logically then also synonymous with truth and goodness and beauty. And just knowing that is enough to ground the Christian artist and the Christian craftsman and the place where art and craft meet, really for a lifetime of practice. And so just that kind of a sense that, okay, beauty is a transcendental signifier that points us toward God, that gives me something to ground my aiming for beauty in. That beauty is not just in the eye of the beholder, but rather beauty is in the being of God. And then on top of that, as I explored more and started thinking about the incarnation and its implications in art, that Christ comes, as the creed says, he suffered under Pontius Pilate, right? He didn't just sort of materialize nowhere and no place as no one, right? Jesus of Nazareth, in a particular time, in a particular place, in the physical body, in the created world. This says to me that detail matters, attention matters in art. And I think that attention is really the essence of the art of poetry, looking at all the things that are, so to speak.
That resonates with me a lot. Yeah. One of the things that I find that my own faith inspires in me is a kind of a reminder of the need to look twice or three times at something, right? To not dismiss things that might on their surface not strike me because they might seem ordinary. That a lot of times what the Christian vision is about the disclosure of the extraordinary inside the ordinary, right? That's not a gardener, it's Jesus, right? And then John chapter 20, Mary at the tomb, right?
Oh, that's a wonderful example.
You know, I which is one of my, that's, I think my favorite passage in all of scripture is John chapter 20, that story right there. Okay, let me ask you about this then. A few more questions here from your book, A Poetics of Orthodoxy, which I really like. You state in the book's introduction that you believe that all good poetry is, and this is a provocative phrase, it's inherently unsecular, right? And that even non-Christian art is an example of God's grace. It's such a provocative comment. Can you explain why you think this is so?
Yes, I guess maybe I am guilty of being provocative there a little bit. I couldn't help it. But one thing that just really struck me as I was working on that book is the way that beauty mirrors grace in how it comes to us undeserved, and in this case, even in some ways, unsought for consciously. We don't even perhaps know always that we're seeking beauty. You might be, as I was this morning, driving down a rural Oklahoma highway on the way to campus, and suddenly astounded by the sunrise. And I was not in search of a sunrise, certainly. And I wasn't thinking about beauty. I was thinking about faculty meetings. And suddenly there it was, just sort of offering itself to me, right? And so it's the wonderfully gratuitous nature of art that I think gives it that ability to mirror the way grace is experienced and works in the world. And so that's kind of the overview. And then there's some particulars within, I think, poetic practice in particular that are naturally kind of anti-secular. The use of metaphor, for example, right? In the secular sort of nominalist world, everything is just discretely itself and has no meaning, right? To say in a secular frame, what is the meaning of that tree, is a nonsensical question. But what metaphor does is connect things in ways that we can talk about the world as a book, the world as a meaning. And so I think anyone who makes metaphor in some ways is pushing against secular assumptions about the flatness of the world and the meaninglessness of the world.
Yeah, it's great. World is God's footstool, you know. Yeah, metaphor to suggest you can see more through things in the world than just those things themselves, right?
Exactly, that nothing is just itself. And
Right.
certainly what poetry does is take up, the wind hover or any sort of thing and say, as you said earlier, look twice because there's more here than we may have realized.
Yeah, it's a great idea, and this is one I plan to teach this book in classes of mine in the future because it makes that point really, really well. So let me ask you about this. So as college has become more expensive, I mean, I'm thinking now the state of higher education, and really crushingly expensive in some cases for many students and their families, there's been an increasing emphasis on earning a degree that will net graduates a high-paying job directly after graduation, right? Now, my college at BYU, the College of Humanities, has done a lot of work trying to dispel the myth that falsely opposes high-paying jobs on the one hand from degrees in literature or language or philosophy or art history on the other hand. Such degrees in the humanities can lead to high-paying jobs in very lucrative careers, et cetera. But in your book, you take this in a theological direction, which I really like. I really appreciate this. You argue that, I'm quoting you here, we need the arts in our Christian universities. The arts expand a student's concept of what it means to be a human being made in the image of God. So I'm wondering if you could elaborate first, and then second, what do you say to parents or to students, who claim that they'll rely on churches to instill a sense of what it means to be a child of God, that what they want education to do is provide gainful employment?
Thank you for that question. That's great. My radical idea in education is that students should be educated as if they are human beings in possession of an immortal soul, because they are, right? And that knowing that ought to change everything we do. It ought to inform everything we do, that we shouldn't compartmentalize into, well, Sunday's for care of the soul, and Monday through Friday we're going to focus on material concerns. I suppose even if we were to compartmentalize, that would still just be the exact wrong ratio of things. Right. So if someone wants to discuss flipping that, I'd maybe entertain that. But meanwhile, I think the goal is to integrate that biblical understanding of who we are as mind body combinations, soul body combinations, into everything we do, which doesn't mean it's totally without regard to vocation. Right, which is also something that should be considered soulfully. So I teach in a great books program, works with any major on campus, and I often say, I'm not just after the English majors and the philosophy majors, that I really want our future nurses to read the Iliad with me and think about suffering and suffering as part of the human condition, so that at the very least they're not shocked beyond functioning when they realize that it is indeed part of the human condition, right? It's this wonderful moment, the consolation of philosophy, when Lady Philosophy says to Boethius, "Your problem is you've forgotten all your reading in the classics, and you don't know what to expect from life." Right? And I think, the arts, along with philosophy, along with history, the liberal arts more broadly, really help us understand this is what human life is and has been from the beginning, and this is what I should expect from it, regardless of my career, which is a kind of deepening of the soul, really. The student who graduates from a Christian university, certainly, and hopefully any university, graduates with a soul that's been thickened up considerably, I hope.
That's a nice phrase, a soul that's been thickened up. Yeah, I really appreciate that. I know I teach a class in literature and spiritual experience, and one day we had a really good discussion in class about ways in which a certain set of poems really animate and give expression to subtle dimensions of spiritual life. And I just paused and I said, so tell your parents when they ask what you're doing in your English major, that you're learning how to be more discerning of the Spirit of God. You know, so that, you know, and which is an important thing in addition to, right, now getting a job too, that's great. I'm not knocking that. It's that it's the false opposition that kind of gets to me, which also ends up cheapening, it risks cheapening what we actually learn, what we're supposed to be kind of forming ourselves to be, you know, in college. So thank you for your thoughts on that. I love your words there. Let me ask about one more thing from your book here, A Poetics of Orthodoxy. It concerns your vision of Christian art. This is a really compelling vision. You write that Christian art, and I'll quote you again here, must capture the in-betweenness, the something good and the something missing of our lives in the fallen world. And you say that beauty comes to us as a disruption that teaches us how to love God. What's the relationship between this poetic imperative toward in-betweenness and disruptive, almost revelatory beauty? And is the relationship between these things a conscious thought for you as you craft your own poetry?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think a lot of my thinking on that is really rooted in Augustine, who in the Confessions makes this, it's kind of almost an aside, but he suggests, you know, all of our happiness is this memory of Eden, right? That somehow lingers in our souls, that in any happiness we experience in this world, it's something is reminding us of that original closeness to God and that sort of Edenic experience. And I think that that art, in order to work emotionally, to reach into our humanity, then really has to tap into not just the feeling that something is wrong, but also the feeling that something is wrong that should be right, that could be right. That we're not just fallen to the ground, and we're certainly not still flying through the skies, but that we're suspended between the two, right? As Hamlet says, crawling between heaven and earth. And so, you know, there's this poignancy, I think, in that that better captures our experience than an optimism, right? Which is a different thing from hope, I think. Or a despair, right? A hopelessness.
That's so powerful to me. I love the thought. I mean, one of the things that I find so compelling about the Christian vision, right, is this promise of redemption, right? That's always implicit in things. It means that nothing that you look at is ever just itself. It's back to your point about metaphor, right? Although here the metaphor is not just the connectedness to God, other parts of God's creation, but the connectedness to what one may still be through Christ, right? And that is one therefore is a walking metaphor, right? So we find ourselves in this in-between state already, right? Not fully realized. And it's that break-in of disruptive beauty, this grace you talk about, right? That is such a powerful disclosure of possibility for what we might be, for who we are at some
I
level.
like that. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. You know, it makes me think about how Jesus constantly says both the kingdom of God is here and the kingdom of God is near. And so, you know, you start thinking, well, is it here or is it near? And the answer is yes, right? That kind of not yet already dynamic that is so much a part of, you know, living as a redeemed person, to be redeemed, who is being redeemed, and to experience the world in that same way. I think going back to our earlier discussion, that if that's not subject matter for art, I just don't know what is.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Ben. I want to turn here to your collection of poems, The Family Book of Martyrs, which I love. What was the inspiration for this collection?
You know, this collection really comes out of the years from when my children were small into their teenage years where they are now. So it's a project of fatherhood, really, and the anxieties of fatherhood, which caused a lot of reflections on my own childhood and sort of family history and dynamics, and thinking about that kind of ordinary experience alongside interestingly, church history and the experience, the extraordinary experiences of the martyrs and of sacrifice. And so in some ways the title is meant in jest, right? Every family has its martyrs, certainly. But also there's a serious cast to it as well, right? To really love is to give up some part of the self, right? To
Yeah.
abandon. And I think, like most people, there I didn't learn that probably as soon as I should have. There are several ways to learn it, and certainly parenting is one, right? Causes self-examination. It forces us into a often a kind of self-sacrifice that we can't even take credit for because it's beyond a choice. It's just what you do.
I chuckled a second ago when you said that, but beneath the chuckle was also a groan, because the dimensions and the dichotomies of parenting are really so striking. There's nothing quite like it in my experience. Now I love this collection of yours, and I find it is a very diverse collection. And you mentioned the extraordinary and the ordinary, and they're in different poems. They're often brought together in the same poem, and some poems are clearly religious, others are not. So obviously so, right? I'm wondering how you would characterize the collection, whether you would describe it as Christian art. I guess I'm wondering, thinking back to a later conversation, how Ben the literary critic would assess the collection by Ben the poet.
that's a good question, and probably one that I could discuss with a therapist for hours, I think. And part of me wants to say, well, my goal is clearly to make sure I narrow my audience down as little as possible. I mean, obviously, I'm the guy who wrote a book about theology and poetry previous to this, so I could, exploit that piece of the Venn diagram. But this, I think it's really that I don't have so much a secular category. There are poems that may not include the name of Christ in them directly, or may not allude to the doctrine of the Trinity, or directly discuss church history. But even when I'm writing about my anxieties, as I often am in this book, I'm doing so kind of with the sixth chapter of Matthew in mind, that that my worries for today are sufficient for today, and that addressing these for me is in some ways a process of laying those anxieties out before the Lord, confessing in some ways. I don't think most people would describe me as a confessional poet in the sense of Lowell or Plath, but I think every poem is a kind of confession of sorts, and so I try to blur that secular sacred dichotomy as much as I can.
I appreciate that. One of the things that occurs to me as you're talking about that is that, if you as you say, you have no secular category. When these things are of a piece for you, right? When all things are sacred, which does not mean they can't also be things of the world, but they're also sacred things. You can kind of treat things as one thing, but the oneness has about it this multiplicity. It reminds me also of Matthew 6, the end of that chapter, is seek the kingdom of God first and all these things added to you, which can be read as like a promise of reward, but can also just be a promise also that you're more perceptive of ordinary things. All these things added to your perception, your capacity to sort of comment on them.
I love that. This suggestion that everything kind of falls in after and into the kingdom of God. I think a lot of ways, I think my this clearest statement of my poetics is just the great line from Richard Wilbur that love calls us to the things of this world. And it calls us to the things of this world, not as worldly things in the biblical sense, right? But as the things of creation and the things of redemption and the kingdom. And so even if I'm writing about, playing basketball with my childhood friends, I'm trying to think of it as part of that story of redemption.
I love that poem, by the way, that poem about childhood friends and basketball. That's a great
Thanks.
poem. So in the favorite books conversation I had with George Hanley, I remarked that this is my sense. I'm going to now tell you something that I said there on that podcast. And I want to know your reaction to it. I remarked that one of your gifts, as I at least perceive it, and one of your gifts as a poet is in creating a deep sense of narrative truth through poetic snapshots. Like that basketball poem is a classic case in point because it talks about like basketball over years, and the thoughts of what time you kind of renders on all of us, and there's these little snapshots in these poems that have a sense of narrative depth to them. There's a rich sense of background that you give through these images, these fragments. And so the people that you mentioned in the poems had this, there's a sense you can create these rich lives outside the framework of the poems in which they appear. So that there's a really, for me, there's a really textured quality to the people to whom you turn our attention in your poems. And I think I called the poems elegantly loving. That was like a phrase I used with George. When you hear me say that, do you say, yeah, or do you say, man, what have you been smoking? I don't smoke, by the way. I'm a Latter-day Saint, but still, right? Right?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is thank you. I mean that's an incredibly charitable, critical assessment, and so I'm grateful for that. My mother is a novelist, and I've learned a
Oh.
lot from her about character development, about the richness of a character in a work, and sort of in the work I've done teaching creative writing, I've thought a lot even about theological groundings for things we say, like, well, you need round characters rather than flat characters, right? And occasionally a really good student will challenge me on that and say, well, why do I need round characters? Okay. And I think the answer is has to be grounded in the reality of who we are as beings made in God's image, right? That's worth honoring in our art. So, a lot of the people in my poems are real people, so I owe them sort of extra character development, roundness, fullness. But even the composite portraits, even the occasional invented character, I did a previous book of poems that was entirely a fictional narrative. Even those characters, I feel like I owe them the acknowledgement that human beings are made in the image of God, and so that, the human creation should never be treated as a one-dimensional cardboard creation.
Yeah, there's a, you put it, the way you put it there, it connects kind of the aesthetic of how you craft these things to the ethic, if all creatures are, sort of creatures of God, then there is a kind of a more than a single dimension to them. There is a almost a responsibility, not just an aesthetic advantage to write to creating kind of a more rounded character that way.
I think that's right. Artists, the material we work with, it's often it's the human material. And I think, the same way a farmer working with the land has a stewardship responsibility to care for the land, the artist working with humanity has a stewardship responsibility as well.
Okay, so I want to get into this collection a little bit, and I've got a question I want to ask at the back end of a kind of a discussion of parts of a couple poems in here that are very. It speaks to the diversity of the collection. These are very different poems from each other, and they're both so striking, but so different. And I wanted to maybe look at parts of these two poems and then pose a question about them and how they sort of in their contrast with each other. The first is this poem titled The Cat in the Cistern. It's on page 18. Let me, and this is a, you know, kind of about how there's an old house with a cistern down beneath the porch, and, you know, and the poet, whether it's you or an imagined scenario, hears this small cat. It's gotten down in there. And there's no way to get down in there other than put sort of things down to hope the cat grabs onto it, and then you can lift the cat up. And you try and you try, and it's not working. And let me read the last bit of that poem here, the last, I don't know, 10-ish or so lines. You say, two more days spent trying to get the cat to snatch the volleyball net we lowered into the hole, and then we quit. We turn the music up so that the kids can't hear the mewlings float like lost balloons by one or two from down below the sagging porch. I cannot save them all, the things that want me to. Turn up the Mozart more until the bawling stops. And when it does, it will not be the same silence with which we started. Okay, that's such, to me, such a haunting poem. It's devastatingly sad in some ways. But I contrast that, okay, with the poem Praying for Dogs on page 104. Would you like just read the rest of the first stanza of this poem?
Sure. Praying for Dogs. A tumor like a portobello on its neck, a Pomeranian has poked its head into my timeline where its owner posts, please pray. And later at the Wednesday night prayer meeting, Widow Jones requests a word of intercession for her labradoodle who has a blockage in his doggy gut and is as bloated as a bullfrog's chin. And so at night, I find myself in prayer like this. O Lord of endless mercy, Lord of grace and wonder, please bring healing down to Cupcake and to Captain Fluffy Face.
I read that for the first time. I was at home and I was just like, it was like at night, and I burst out into laughter and told my wife, you got to look at this. You got to hear this. I read this to her. It captures, right? People, of course, pets are living creatures, right? And we're so attached to them, and they do get sick and ill, and it's so sad. But there's also such an absurdity to these, to our relationship with them, right? Captain Fluffy Face, right? Bring down the powers of heaven to heal. So these two poems side by side, right? The first is so melancholic, right? It's horrified not only by the death of a small creature, but by your own reflections on how you're unable to save so many things that need saving, right? Your inability to keep that sober reality from your children. But the second poem then has great fun with the ridiculousness of our humanity and how we imagine and name our pets. So in some ways, the second poem highlights the absurdity of our existence, even amid kind of the more serious realities, you know, of love and care and disease and death, right? So the first poem kind of evokes tragedy. The second, absurdity. This is kind of, making a simple juxtaposition, but it's for this purpose. Both these traits, okay, tragedy on one end, absurdity on the other, are sometimes used or evoked to dismiss the existence of God, right? So if God exists, why do bad things happen? The tragic line. Or if God exists, why is his creation so ridiculous? Why is life so absurd? Kind of the other one, right? For you, do these poems in any way speak to or counter these kinds of reflexes? Do they lean into them? I mean, I'm curious what Ben, the literary critic, would say, right, about these poems and the questions they implicitly raise.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. There are several animal poems in the book, and that has a lot to do with my children's obsession with animals. But, you know, to me, these two poems are really close together, and it's a slight nudge into the comic or into the tragic. And really, what I'm trying to do overall, I think, is capture the tragic comic. You know, my favorite Shakespeare play, when people ask, you know, I always say it's The Winter's Tale. It's the tragic comedy, because pure tragedy, I think, is essentially a pagan mode of literature, that the universe is meaningless and harsh, and in the end, what happens happens, and that's the end. You know, that's sort of the Greek concept of Moira or fate, or the Anglo-Saxon doom or weird. And then, so that's clearly not consonant with the Christian vision, but neither is the purely comic vision, right? That, you know, it's all just a farce, and none of it hurts, and none of it matters in the end. I don't think that makes sense given the fact of eternity, right? And so I think that tragicomic, or you know, the romance, to use the literary genre term, I think is the most appropriate Christian literary mode. I don't, you know, I think my ultimate goal would be to capture that dichotomy, or that not dichotomy, but that bond, that pairing in every poem. Sometimes I have to kind of go back and forth between poems to get it, because it's hard to capture in the economy of a lyric poem. You need something like the Divine Comedy to do it.
Yeah, right. But you do speak. I really like that, Ben. And these poems do capture so much of that really great tragic comedy you're talking about, or what you described in the book Protest for Orthodoxy, this in-betweenness of our experience. Even that poem Praying for Dogs, which you just read, I love how it ends. It's the last four lines. To pray for one dog is to pray for all of us, and so I bow my head again, scoop up the scattered kibbles and loose bits, and kneel beside the sloppy water dish. Right? And there's something so homey and yet so recognizing, you know, of our own homely humanity, the fact that our lives are so both mundane and sublime. And that's kind of what it means to be, you know, a creature of God in a fallen but still beautiful world. And so I really appreciate how these poems kind of walk that line really expertly. Is there a poem in the collection that you like, especially the one that really stands out to you? It's a hard
You know,
question because you wrote all of them.
that's right. That's right. You know what? I think maybe Elizabeth Discovers Rock and Roll
That's great.
is a poem that means a lot to me.
I
And I
love
have to
that.
say, you know, it's a poem I wrote for my middle daughter, and I noticed later she's a middle child of a younger son and two daughters, and she's the only one whose name shows up in it, so that's a little kind of like middle child gift, I think, to
Yeah.
her to get named there. So I could read
Would you
that if
please?
you.
Yeah, this is a great
Yeah.
poem.
Elizabeth Discovers Rock and Roll. Arms angled, thin and small, waving above her head. My 5-year-old daughter is dancing like a maenad in the morning light of the white tiled bathroom. An old clock radio in a windowsill up high coughs out AM oldies while I bathe her little brother. She is slapping the cold tile with her bare toes, swirling the bath mat as she twirls beside the toilet. Her great grandparents danced this freely at house dances in Oklahoma in the 30s. Heavy furniture pushed back against the walls, rugs rolled up, they swung each other across wooden floor like a carnival ride, while outside, men passed a jug of something fiery sweet in the moon shadow of the farmhouse, listened while fiddles and guitars thrummed fingers against the black edges of night. Now their descendant dances between the pedestal sinks, knocking the towel from its hanging ring while the big bopper sings Chantilly Lace. Later, I will switch off the radio when a report comes on about a man in Texas who has barricaded himself and his young son into their home and set the whole thing on fire. Because this is not the morning she discovers the long burning fuse of alcoholism that snakes sizzling into her genes, or the rages and sulks that soak and chafe her ancestral heart. This is not the morning she finds out how we have counted the things of this world by putting one bullet in each. The light stumbles in through the blinds. spills itself on the white tile floor, where Elizabeth dances like David before the Lord, her last baby fat bouncing in a slight paunch above her thin legs. The morning tilts itself toward 8 o'clock, and I am praying now, my daughter, for you. Eyes to see even in the weight of darkness around us, and feet to move all the way through it.
Bravo. That's a beautiful poem. You know, this
Thank
is one
you.
Of my favorites in the collection. And it's so great at capturing kind of the exuberance of a young child dancing to music, right? But then I really appreciate how you break in here with, you know, you'll turn off the radio later when the reports come on from the news about kind of the grim things of existence. And that three line sequence, that little sentence there, this is not the morning she finds out how we have counted the things of this world by putting one bullet in each. I mean, there's so much poignancy there for any parent or any close observer, you know, of the world where there is such beauty and such innocence and such, you know, sort of a effervescence to things on the one hand, but just so much pain, tragedy, hurt, misunderstanding, evil, misdeed. I mean, all these things exist here, and it's like, let's not do that yet. I mean, I want to teach you before you're too old and you learn it from somebody else, but you're not there yet. Today, it's just David dancing before the Lord.
It's one of the hardest things in parenting, right? To help them know what to expect from the world, but not to let that crush them, right?
Yeah.
Not to let too much in too soon. It's, you know, what makes them stronger and what puts them in danger, and just constant discernment is what it takes.
We just maybe do one more poem. I mean, I don't have a lot more time, but this is such a great conversation. We read one more poem from the collection that I personally just love. It's the last poem. It's the poem Field. And hopefully, but you read it for us. The poet's voice is better than my own here. But I'm also interested in this. I mean, it's a beautiful poem. I'd love also to know why this is the last one in the collection.
Yeah. Okay, should I read it first?
Let's
and
do
then
that,
explain,
yeah.
Maybe?
That'd be great,
That'd be
perfect,
great.
Yeah.
Field. Heaven is a field I am driving an old truck across, and the only dream I have on the subject. The sky over that pasture is so blue, I know it will burst if it doesn't turn 20 different reds at evening. The truck is my granddad's 72 Ford, still smelling of oil field aftershave. When it stalls, I get out and lift the hood, but look instead into the everlasting distance, dotted with cattle and streaked with blotches where the henbit has bruised the pasture purple. I think of my father lifting me onto his lap to let me drive as we bumped over clumps of gopher dirt in the pasture. How I steered wildly through the grass, his boot barely on the gas. But it is my father-in-law who is standing next to me when I look, who has bloodied his knuckles, starting the engine, running again, who is gesturing with a patience he rarely had in life, for me to get back into the truck and drive on. I wake to hear our children breathe their sleep one room over, and to tell you, love of all my lifetime, as we lie beneath our ceiling, in the middle of our bed, in the middle of our life, that heaven has a field full of fathers. I have been there. I am one of them.
I love that poem. Thank you, Ben. Well,
thank you so much. It's really, you know, I think I end with that poem because that to me is the best statement I could find of that sort of waiting in hope, right? A little glimpse of what's ahead, right? But still waking up in the middle of it all, with that sense of having been there. It's really the, again, the in-betweenness, the not yet already, that I'm aiming for there. And also, it felt right to end with a poem for my wife. I wouldn't want to write a book about parenting that seems to imply that I'm doing this at all on my own.
Right. I love there are four fathers in here, right? There's your grandfather, your father, there's you and your father-in-law. And it does end on the note they're talking with your wife and to her, right? Which is a great touch. I was so moved by this. First of all, the connection of that field to heaven, that there's something about heaven which is deeply evocative of our lives here in a way that can make our lives here also evocative of things heavenly. I love that. And how you say about your father-in-law, he's bloodied his knuckles, starting the engine running again, who was gesturing with a patience he rarely had in life, right? As though there are aspects to us that do not all appear at the present time. It's so great about capturing kind of the details of the present, deeply embedded in the association in the poet's memory, and yet it evokes also possibility beyond any memory you would have had.
I
Right? Redemptive
appreciate that.
possibility. Yeah, it's lovely. It's great. I have time for one more question here, Ben. Let me ask you this. As a question I like asking poets when I have them on here. What is work that you would like to do that still seems maybe a little bit beyond your capacity, right? What inspiration do you seek, for poetry that you'd like to create that still seems a little bit out there?
Yeah, I love that question. That's such a great question. A lot of days, just writing anything seems beyond my capacity, right? I think most poets wrestle with the feeling that, especially if you like, that rare occasion where you like what you have just written, the immediate feeling is, oh no, I may never write another one again. This may be it. And that's in part, I think, maybe God's way of calling us into to relying on Him in the artistic process. I know I'm not going to be able to just summon it up out of myself somehow. But as far as kind of artistic ambitions, really one thing I've wanted to do for a long time is translation. Particularly, I've been daydreaming for a number of years about translating Virgil's eclogues, which, this wonderful Roman poetry that in the Middle Ages many found sort of suggestive of Christian truth as a kind of hidden prophecy. And then certainly just beautiful, beautiful poetry in the Latin. I don't think my Latin is yet up to it, right? I've been trying to go back to my graduate studies and refresh that. So that's probably my dearest ambition, right? If only I could have a sabbatical and freshen up my Latin and crack into the eclogues, I think.
Okay. Well, one day, right?
One day,
Maybe I'll write a
yes.
poem about Ben, how you spoke with a Latin you rarely had in life. Maybe I'll do that.
That's
Okay. So,
great. I would appreciate that.
right. This has been a great conversation, Ben. Thank you so much for your thoughtful work and for just making lots of great contributions to the arts in many capacities. All blessings to you.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.